So what I'm going to do today is present evidence that the fine structure constant may be varying over cosmological timescales. And notice how I emphasize the word may. And I do that because my collaborators and I feel we have possible evidence for it. We don't think we have conclusive evidence that the fine structure constant is changing. However, I think the results are potentially very exciting because the published result that we had was a 4 sigma event. Since then, I'll show some new unpublished data. And as we add more data, what was a 4 sigma result is now a 6 sigma result. So either we found something or there's some systematic error lurking around that we haven't been able to locate, which causes a result. And a lot of my talk will be discussing the sources of systematic error. So what I'm going to do is start out giving an introduction. The way we probe back in time, the reason we can measure the fine structure constant over cosmological timescales is because we look far back in time using quasar absorption lines. This is not my main bag at all that I'm talking about today, but what I really work on is galaxy formation, looking at very distant objects, but the same data that I've used for that is also useful for measuring the fine structure constant. So I'll talk about how I got into this field. I got into measuring physical constants many years ago, about 25 years ago. I'll talk about my original motivations. Then I'll talk about the more recent work. Since I've been at UCSD, I've been lucky enough to use the Keck telescope, which is without doubt the best telescope in the world. Though maybe some other people don't agree with that. With the Keck telescope, we've been able to measure spectra with unprecedented accuracy. So I'll talk about the Keck high-res project, and I'll talk about the new technique we have for measuring the fine structure constants called the many-multiplet technique. I'll then discuss the data, the results, and as I said, I'll spend a fair amount of time talking about systematic errors because that's really what we have to look at in order to begin to believe the result. And then I'll talk about the new unpublished data and then some independent methods that people have used to measure the fine structure constant. So as I said, the way we do this is we look at very distant quasars. And the reason we use quasars is that they're basically very bright flashlights that shine, and we can see them very, very far away. They're typically 100,000 times more luminous than an entire galaxy, yet they're only 1 light year in diameter. And this is perfect for us because the light from the quasar propagates through the universe, and as it does, it interacts with matter, and that's why we get a handle on the fine structure constant. So this is a spectrum. Is there a pointer?
Yes.
This is a spectrum of a quasar. Where is it? The big stick. Okay. All right. So this is a spectrum of a quasar. Okay. And what we're just plotting here is flux versus wavelength. And this is a Keck spectrum. And so just notice here first that you have basically a flat continuum that's probably synchrotron radiation coming from matter spiraling down to a black hole. And what's characteristic about quasar spectra is you have a very strong emission line. This is Lyman alpha. It ought to be at 1216 angstroms, but notice it's at a much larger wavelength due to the expansion of the universe. It's been redshifted. And notice at the short wavelength side of Lyman alpha emission, there's many, many, many absorption lines, which I'll show in a minute. I'll explain what they are. They're called the Lyman alpha forest. And at the long wavelength side, there are much fewer, there are very few absorption lines. And these are really what I'm going to focus on today. So that just wanted to show you what the data looks like. Now, how do we interpret such a spectrum? Well, here's sort of a toy model, schematic model. Here, the light from the quasar propagates from a distant universe to the Earth. On its way to us, it passes through the outskirts of galaxies, probably some intergalactic filaments, et cetera, et cetera. And what happens is as light leaves the quasar because of the cosmological expansion, the light gets redshifted, and it gets shifted into the rest frame frequencies, which correspond to some transitions of atomic transitions, hyperfine resonance transitions, whatever, and give rise to absorption lines. So for those of you who are not familiar with cosmology, I thought I'd just say a few words about that. Basically, what's going on, of course, the universe is expanding, and it expands in such a way that the further away an object is from us over here, the higher its recessional velocity. So if this is the quasar, Okay, anything in front of the quasar has a smaller redshift with respect to us. So the quasar emits this Lyman alpha radiation. Okay. The Lyman alpha line that's being emitted by the quasar will have a much higher redshift than, say, a Lyman alpha line that's being absorbed due to matter in front of the quasar. Okay. So what happens is as the photons come from the quasar, they excite a Lyman alpha transition over here. The excited states decays by spontaneous photon emission, which is isotropic. So there's a net, and so it's unlikely that the emitted photon is in the same direction as the incident photon. So the net effect is an absorption line. And for those of you that know about it, the definition of redshift is given by that the observed frequency is 1 plus the redshift, or the observed wavelength, rather, is 1 plus the redshift times the wavelength in the rest frame of the object. So as a result, you can interpret all these absorption lines are clearly Lyman alpha absorption lines, okay? And the ones over here have a higher redshift than the ones over here. The ones over here, these Lyman alpha absorption lines come from gas further away than the Lyman alpha absorption lines over here. Now, it turns out I'm not interested in those Lyman alpha absorption lines. A lot of people make a living from that. It's called the Lyman alpha forest. For me, they're a source of noise and confusion. What I'm much more interested in is this very strong Lyman alpha line. I should say that the Lyman alpha forest is very interesting for cosmology. It's mainly arises in intergalactic filaments that are highly ionized. And what we're seeing here is the neutral fraction, the neutral tail of the hydrogen. Basically, only one out of every 10 to the 5 atoms is neutral in the Lyman alpha forest. But this absorption line is really what I'm interested in. This is a very strong absorption line. This comes from, as I show over here, probably the outskirts of the galaxy. This comes from very neutral gas. The column density here is much higher. Here, typically, the column density of neutral hydrogen is 10 to the 14, 10 to the 13 particles per square centimeter. Here, it's like the disk of our galaxy. It's about 10 to the 21 particles per square centimeter. Whereas these lines, if we focus in on, they're broadened by the Doppler effect. This line is broadened by quantum mechanics. What we're seeing here is a natural broadening, okay, due to the finite width of the two-piece state. We're looking at the Lorentz profile. Now, because there's so much gas in this, we can also see metal absorption lines, which you typically don't see over here. It's not enough gas, because metals have a much lower abundance. So schematically, you can see at the same redshift as this, what's called a damp Lyman alpha line, we also see singly ionized silicon, singly ionized carbon. And it's from these type of transitions, okay, that we're going to get a handle on the fine structure constant. Now, I should also say that, I guess it should be fairly obvious, but I'll say it anyway, that the reason we can learn about, we can talk about cosmological timescales is because the age of the universe is correlated with redshift. The type of redshifts that I'm going to be discussing today vary anywhere between 1 and all the way up to 4. So we think we know what the universe is all about these days. We think we know that it's about 13.9 billion years old. So that's a redshift of 2. You know, the look back time is something like 10, 12 billion years. So we're really looking pretty far back in time, probably 80% of the Hubble time, the age of the universe. So this is why these experiments have cosmological significance. Now, occasionally, the background quasar is a radio source. I just depicted it as an optical source, but originally, in fact, the first quasars that were discovered were radio sources. So associated with this optical continuum source, which is about a light year in diameter, there are many cases radio sources emit radio waves. And that's how I got into this field originally. Because by using radio waves, we can learn about the 21 centimeter line. Remember, this is the hyperfine transition in the 1s state of hydrogen. It's a spin flip transition. And the 21 centimeter line is very valuable for learning about physical conditions in galaxies. So I got interested in this a long time ago. And here is an example of a quasar where we see the 21, this is a velocity profile. Now I'm plotting, this is intensity normalized, the unit continuum, and I've converted frequency into Doppler velocity. And so V equals zero corresponds to that redshift over here. And by today's standards, that's a modest redshift, but it was very exciting when it was found. So this is the 21 centimeter velocity profile. And this is a resonance line, okay, due to the optical continuum. Now, they don't agree exactly, and that's not surprising, because in this case, the background radio source is about 30,000 light years in diameter. It's a giant radio source. And many years ago, my colleagues and I showed that the gas covered most of this radio source, where the optical source, as I said, is about 1 light year in diameter. So in some sense, they're not exactly sampling the same hydrogen. But nonetheless, notice that their redshifts agree, okay, in velocity units to about 15 kilometers a second. And so when I noticed that, I realized that that could tell us something about physical constants, that they were constant. And the idea is this. This is a technique that we used a long time ago. And the only way I can understand this is using a space-time diagram. So here's the world line of a quasar. Here's the world line of the absorber. Here's our world line. We look along our past light cone, and the light from the quasar is emitted and gets redshifted into some frequencies, and it could be two frequencies. One could be the radio waves get redshifted into the rest frequency corresponding to the 21 centimeter line. That's 1400 megahertz. And some of the optical radiation gets redshifted to, say, that chromium line, which is a frequency of 10 to the 15 hertz. Now, the nice thing about the expansion of the universe is that it preserves frequency or wavelength ratios. In other words, if I have two frequencies, the ratio nu A to nu B observed equals nu A over nu B at that redshift. Okay? The expansion of the universe is independent of frequency, so that ratio is preserved. So that tells you right away you can learn about physical constants, because I just take this ratio, nu A over nu B observed, divided by that ratio in the laboratory, to form that ratio R. And that's just going to equal the physical constants at some redshift Z divided by the physical constants in the laboratory, because these ratios just depend on physical constants. So for example, the experiment that we did a number of years ago, I'll let nu A be the hyperfine transition. So in that case, the nu A is equal to some dimensionless constant. In this case, it's 8 pi over 3. And you can show it's proportional to alpha squared, where alpha is a fine structure constant, e squared over h bar c, times the gyromagnetic ratio of the proton, times the electron over proton mass, times the Rydberg constant. Okay? Whereas the resonance frequency equals another dimensionless constant times the Rydberg constant. So when I form these ratios, the Rydberg constant cancels out. And what this dimensionless number then is equal to this product of physical constants at that absorption event divided by that product of physical constants in a laboratory. And when you work it out, it's just equal to 1 plus the optical redshift divided by 1 plus the 21 centimeter redshift. So that means that the change in physical constants from the laboratory value is just equal to the error, the accuracy to which those two redshifts agree divided by 1 plus z. And in this case, it was a number on the order of 10 to the minus 4. So we did this in 4 or 5 different absorption events. For those relativists, those absorption events that had passed light cones that were hardly overlapping. So we got very excited about this. This meant to us that the physical constants were the same everywhere. Okay, now you can do the same trick. This is for the fine structure constant by itself. This technique wasn't my idea. This was Bacall and Schmidt, who looked at an alkali doublet, okay, where you have a lower S state and a higher P state, and that P state is split by the spin-orbit interaction. Okay, and in this case, nu A is just the wavelength or frequency difference between this transition energy and that transition energy, and nu B is just one of these resonance lines. So I go through the same procedure, and in this case, this ratio is just alpha squared at the redshift event divided by alpha squared in the laboratory. And that's equal to the wavelength. Nu A is, again, the wavelength difference divided by nu B. And in this case, the data we had at that time wasn't that great. And so you could just say that the relative change of the fine structure constant squared over alpha squared was a few times 10 to the minus 4. So this work was done about 25 years ago. And then I said, well, you know, I'm going to get out of this field. I mean, why should I just sit around measuring upper limits? It was kind of boring. So what happened about 4 years ago, I was at a meeting in Paris, and a friend of mine, John Webb, who's an astronomer in Australia, said, I'd like to have all your Keck data. I want to go measure alpha squared. And I said, what do you want to do that for? This is just more upper limits. It's boring. And he says, no, I have a new technique that's better than your technique. It's about a factor of 10 better. give me your data. I said, okay. So I gave him the data. And he wasn't kidding. So that's what I'm going to talk about today, is what came out of this technique. So I'll say a little bit about motivations. I mean, I don't think to this audience I really have to an astronomy audience, I really have to go into motivations, because astronomers take this for granted, that physical constants are the same. But what excited me many years ago, there was a book by Hawking and Ellis on the large-scale structure of space-time. And the opening sentence of that book is just this, that we make an assumption that we can extrapolate local physical laws throughout space-time, but it's an unproven assumption. So if you could really show that the physical constants are the same everywhere, I think that goes a long way into showing that the physical laws are the same. Of course, this whole idea of changing physical constants really originated with Dirac in 1937 with his large number hypothesis, where he showed that the ratio of the electromagnetic interaction between an electron and a proton divided by its gravitational interaction was a large number, about 10 to the 4, and coincidentally, that number equaled the age of the universe divided by the Compton time, or by also the time it takes for light to travel across the classical electron radius. And he thought that this coincidence was not a coincidence, that it was some underlying meaning, and that agreement always held. And since the age of the universe changes as the universe gets older, that means that some of these physical constants might have to change. And of course, more recently, in areas that I'm very unfamiliar with, but in Kaluza-Klein theories and in string theories, there are predictions that the fine structure constant is proportional to 1 over the mean radius of the compact dimensions and extra dimension theories, and there are predictions that these compact dimensions might vary, and then alpha would vary. And in string theory, from what I'm told, that alpha is the vacuum expectation values of some fields, the dilaton field. So if these scalar fields change, then alpha will change. And a lot of theorists have expressed the opinion that measuring the changes of fine structure constants provides a window into extra dimensions. So that's a very good reason to go at it. So before I launch into it, let me just say who my collaborators are. As I said, John Webb is the leader, and his student Michael Murphy, they've done most of the analysis. The data was supplied by these people and myself. Some of you may know Walt Sargent. Jason Prochaska is a former student of mine. The atomic physics, which is very important here, was provided by two Russian theorists in Australia. And John Barrow kind of provided the global concepts. So let me talk about the atomic physics of this method. So what Flambaum and Juba did is they solved the Dirac equation, okay, for a multi-electron atom. Many atoms, so it's a many-body theory. And what the solutions look something like this, that the energy of a valence electron in a principal quantum number n is equal to the non-relativistic energy plus the relativistic correction, okay, where the relativistic correction to this energy goes like minus z alpha squared times this energy en to the 3/2 power times 1 over the total angular momentum, eigenvalue plus a half, minus this thing that they calculated, the many-body correction. And this stuff is crucial in the method that I'll talk about. So there are three effects that arise of this. The first is the Z effect. So you can see right away that if I have an atom which has a low nuclear charge compared to an atom with a high nuclear charge, the atom with a high nuclear charge, if the fine structure, say, increases, the energies, okay, increase much more for high Z than for low Z, because the change in energy goes like Z squared, okay? So what this tells us is that heavy nuclei are going to be much more sensitive to changes in alpha than light nuclei. That's the first effect. The second effect... Yeah, that's the next effect. Right, exactly. Yeah, you're right. As was just said, for if I'm in an S state, okay, so let's say I have a low J state, okay, what happens there is that the valence electron spends a lot of time near the nucleus, penetrates the screening electron. So as I increase alpha, it'll become more tightly bound. On the other hand, if I have, say, a D state, that electron spends a lot of time further away from the nucleus. So as I increase alpha, the screening electrons become more tightly bound. The effective nuclear charge seen by that valence electron becomes smaller, and then the state becomes weaker and the energy increases. So as you just said, in that case, the energy shifts in this direction. And that's crucial. The fact that low J and high J move in different directions is critical in this whole analysis because it enables us to eliminate systematic effects. It's very difficult to simulate that with any systematic error that we can think of.
How long can you calculate the heat?
That's a very good question. Not too well, about 20%, I think. And we're trying to get people to do that more accurately right now. You mean that C?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the numbers that they've calculated, I think, are between 10 and 20%.
They estimate.
That's what they're estimate.
And there's no direct laboratory test?
Not that I know of. Not yet.
So you really have to believe the theorists a lot.
That's right. That's why I'm trying to get more theorists to do it. But nonetheless, as I'll show you, independent of that, we can rule out the null result, even if they're wrong by some amount. I think you're right that the exact numbers that we're talking about may be off somewhat, but I think we can rule out the null result no matter what, independent of that.
But there's no reason why you cannot measure C in the laboratory, right? Somebody just hasn't done it. No.
I think I'm not familiar with that, to be honest with you. My impression is that that's not straightforward to do that. Okay, so the procedure that I'm going to follow, okay. I mean, we can measure laboratory wavelengths very accurately. I don't know, is that the same as measuring C? It's not clear to me. We can measure the wavelengths to about 1 part in 10 to the 8th now. Okay. All right, so what we can do, this suggests the type of procedure that we'll do. What we'll do is we'll compare heavy and light atoms, for the reasons that I just said before. The light atoms will be anchors. They won't shift very much as alpha changes, but the heavy atoms will change. We'll compare transitions, as I just said before, which are SP transitions compared to DP transitions, and therefore the shifts will be in opposite directions for the reasons I just said. The basic formula that is critical here is this, that a wave number at a redshift z in that rest frame equals a wave number in the laboratory plus this coefficient, which they have to calculate, that we've just been discussing, times alpha z over alpha lab squared minus 1. Okay. So an example is that, here's a numerical example. For iron, singly ionized iron, with z is 26, okay, here's the formula, here's the wave number, shows how accurate it is, and this coefficient times this quantity I'll call x is very large, so a small change in alpha gives rise to a big change in this, whereas magnesium, where z is very small, the coefficient is about a factor of 10 smaller, and it's a much smaller shift. And then again, for a d transition, for a higher angular momentum state, the wave number goes in the opposite direction for the reasons that I just said. Okay. So here's an example of what they calculated. I don't expect you to read all this stuff. The only important thing is I want you to realize that we're using an enormous number of transitions. That's what makes this method very powerful. Whereas with the alkaline method, we can only use 2. That's what makes this incredible. Okay, and that's something that was their realization. Also notice that the Q values, as I promised, for light atoms, they're small. For heavy atoms, they're large. And I notice in some cases, they're negative. And nickel is very important because in nickel alone we have a positive transition and 2 negative transitions. And that's
virtually each one of these atoms you have different C's.
Exactly.
Calculable.
Right, that they have calculated using that many body Hartree-Fock theory. And the Q1s are
calculated.
Yeah, that is what they've calculated. That's what they've calculated independently.
So, although you have a lot of statistics, you have a lot of parameters that you have to take from the theory.
That's right. That's right.
So what do you?
But there's an enormous number.
Errors. You just assume an overall error on each Q1. Yeah.
As I said, the errors that we calculated, I didn't put that in. But their claim is that Q1s are accurate to about 10 and 15%, 10, 20%. That's what their claim is.
They meaning the.
The theorists. Yeah. The atomic physicists. Exactly. Flambaum and Juba.
But there's no other atomic theorists that have verified the
kind of. Are there any here? I mean, I'd like to get other people to do it. I mean, I'm not an atomic theorist, and I
just say a word. I mean, it's crucial, right?
For the final numerical results, it's important, right? But not, but the effect itself, it's not important. To rule out the null hypothesis, it's not important. No, because it's just a product of those two things that matters.
I could for each atom define the Q1 that would give me no effect.
Well, you'd have to say Q1 is zero in every single case.
Zero?
To get a null effect, Q1 have to be zero. I don't think that's correct. But I'm not, you know, I agree that to get the exact numbers, that has to be included.
What is the calculation involved?
It's a Hartree-Fock calculation of the Dirac equation, the relativistic corrections to the atoms, to the energy states. So this is the, schematically, this is what happens if, just give you a flavor for it, if alpha changes, in this case, by 3 parts in 10,000, just to show you that, put a light on it, the orange values are zero, the laboratory value of alpha, and then the black lines, these are the absorption line profiles schematically as a function of wavelength. The black is what happens when I change alpha by this amount. Okay, so again, for the light atoms, you can see there's hardly any change at all, but for the heavy atoms, okay, in this case, iron shifts in this direction to the left, whereas chromium shifts this direction to the right, just to show you schematically what we expect. Okay, and again, I'll just reiterate what I said before, that the advantages of this method is that it includes the relative corrections to these ground states, modulo the accuracy, which I agree is not, still has to be verified. And whereas before we just looked at the changes, we looked at how alpha affects the separation between these two spin orbit shifted states, now we're going to calculate the relativistic correction of each state, and that allows you to include a lot more transitions, which you couldn't do before. Okay, before, for the alkali method, we can only use two at most, three transitions because of selection rules, but now we have a very large sample of transitions of ions and atoms at different frequencies, and as I said before, the opposite signs helps you get rid of systematic errors. So to get an idea, feeling for the magnitude of the effects that we're looking for, they're very small. Okay, so for example, if the fine structure constant changed by 1 part in 10^-5, the shifts that we're looking for in these particular transitions in velocity units range from about 0.2 kilometers a second all the way down to 0.04, 0.03 kilometers a second. That's what we're looking for. And the question is, can we really observe shifts that are that small? Okay, so the data that we have, okay, this is the high resolution, the Schell spectrograph on the Keck telescope. The full width half maximum, okay, the instrumental response function, is about 7 kilometers a second. And we typically have a singleton noise of 30 per pixel. Okay, that's the kind of data we're looking for. In the ideal case of Poisson statistics, no systematic errors, the accuracy to which you can determine the velocity centroid of one of these profiles is given by this formula here. And when you work it out, it's about 0.15 kilometers a second, which is promising. Remember, that's only one transition. We have many. In reality, we don't do that well. It's not as pessimistic as this. I have to revise it. It's more, we typically can do about 0.4, 0.3 kilometers a second. But again, that's only for one transition, one velocity component. The reason we could do much better is that we have multiple transitions, typically 12, 13 transitions in each system, and we have multiple velocity components. And so when you add it all up, we get down to an accuracy better than 0.1 kilometer a second. And that's how we're able to do so well.
And you also look at many different quasars, right?
Oh, yeah. Now about 150 right now.
150.
Yeah, although the data, the published data is based on about 50.
Uh-huh. Wasn't that multiple transitions you refer for the same ion, multiple lines, or for multiple ions?
Both. Many, many transitions in the same ion, many ions. Both.
But could be that different ion movement, different velocity.
That's unlikely, and I'll show you in a minute why I don't think that's true. Okay. Because they would have to move in the same relative way everywhere, every cloud in the universe, and that's what makes it unlikely. But I'll talk about that in a minute. And that's something we have considered. Okay, so here's a schematic. So supposing we have, in this very simple case, we have three different velocity components, okay, that have velocity centroid V1, V2, V3, and silicon. As I said before, to the accuracy that we can measure, you see the same velocity centroids in chromium and, in fact, all the transitions. So we do make the assumption, as someone just said, that all the ions move at the same velocity. Remember, this is not a stellar atmosphere where you can have gravitational settling. These are turbulent clouds. The motions are not thermal. They're turbulent. They're macroscopic. So physically, there's no reason why chromium and nickel should move at different velocities. It really doesn't make much sense. But I'll admit that possibility later, and I'll show why I think it's improbable. So the strength of these absorption features are really determined by three free parameters. Okay, the column density, for example, the number of silicon ions per square centimeter. I'm assuming a Gaussian velocity distribution, which is a very good fit to the data. In fact, most of the time, these lines are unresolved, and the response function of the instrumental profile itself is Gaussian. And we do a convolution to make sure we do that correctly. And VI is the velocity centroid. But now we admit a third free parameter, d alpha over alpha. So we have four free parameters, and multiplying it by the number of transitions and the number of components. So we do a simultaneous chi-square minimization of these multi-components, and we fit those to the line profiles, and that's how we calculate what the fine structure constant would be. So here is the results of those fittings. This is some of the low redshift data. These are, in this case, so this is a redshift system where we have six different transitions, but the important point is that in this redshift system, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, probably other, probably 14, 15 velocity components. That's the important point. Now, of course, these really don't help you because they're saturated. I really can't do much with these. But these other ones are very good for calculating this effect. And we even do better at high redshift. In the low redshift data, the only transitions are these magnesium 2 and iron 2 transitions. In the high redshift data, we have many more transitions. It turns out the high redshift data turns out to be more valuable. So here we have 12 different transitions. And as you can see, the velocity centroids line up extremely well from one transition to the other. Okay, and these are those three nickel lines that I told you about, which are incredibly valuable. Because as alpha changes, they shift in different directions. Okay, now what's important when we measure these things, you need more than one transition even to measure this. Let me just go back to that equation that I showed before. Remember that the wave number in the rest frame at a redshift z equals a laboratory wave number plus this coefficient, this calculated coefficient times 2 d alpha over alpha, where, as I said again, omega z is a laboratory wave number. Omega z is 1 plus z. Okay, so supposing I just had one transition, I calculated the redshift, and then I found out that the alpha of alpha was finite. I mean, that doesn't tell you anything, because all that means is that I made a mistake on my redshift. So I need two transitions. What I really have to look for is a distortion, okay, a compression or an expansion, a separation of wave numbers. So here's an example, low redshift. So here's that magnesium 2 anchor, okay. Starting out, this is the original. The fine structure constant is the same as it is in a laboratory. And at low redshift, iron is always at a shorter wavelength. Okay, now supposing I change the fine structure constant, because both of these have the same sign Q1. If I change the fine structure in some direction, constant in some direction, okay, magnesium hardly moves at all, as I said before, because it's a light element. Iron moves much more because it's a heavy element. So what happens is that there's a compression in wavelength space, or wave number space. Okay, that's what's important. And you just take that equation and you solve it, you see that the change in the relative change in the fine structure constant times 2 is equal to their separation of the wave numbers at high redshift minus the separation between these wave numbers at low redshift. And in this case, they're smaller at high redshift than in the laboratory. So since this difference between the Qs is positive, in this case, what would happen is that a compression in wave number space gives you a negative change in d alpha over alpha. Okay, so that's what we're looking for at low redshift. Whenever I have a compression in a wave number space, the fine structure constant will be smaller at high redshift. will be smaller high redshift than it is today. For the high redshift data, I can't play this trick because there will be trans. I'll have an anchor, which is silicon, then I'll have a heavy element over here. So when I change the fine structure constant, I'll have both an expansion and a compression.
So in that formula, the
yeah.
ones are what order?
Well, as I said before, they're about 1,500 in the appropriate units. I think it's centimeters to the minus one. Okay. So here's the result that we published. Okay. There are 49 different redshift systems that we looked at. Okay, what was published in the paper was just the bin data. This is the actual data. Each one of these is a different redshift system. And as you can see, there are about 20% of the lines have positive the alpha over alpha, 80% have negative the alpha over alpha. Okay, and you know that's when you calculate it, that means that you look at the weighted means and calculate the weighted errors, that the effect is what we published, that we have the fine structure constant, the alpha of alpha is minus 0.72 plus or minus 1.8 times 10 to the minus 5 was a 4 sigma result, okay? And this is the bin data. What we did, just divided up the data. We didn't use this for the analysis, obviously. This is just for display purposes only. We just divided up the data into 7 bins. Each one of those bins contains 7 redshift systems. So there it is, okay? So the question is, and I'll show you later, this effect has gotten better. But in any case, either the effect is real or there is some systematic error which is driving these coefficients down.
So an assumption you make here is that the velocities of the different ions that you're comparing
are the same, exactly.
Now, if you were to try to...
If we have considered what happens if you give each ion, okay, its own velocity. The problem with that idea is you'd have to say no matter where you look in the universe, nickel and iron are always moving like this. Silicon and magnesium are always looking like that.
That wasn't the question. The question is, if you did that, then to fit this data with delta alpha over alpha equal to zero,
it would work.
I know, obviously, you could do it.
Yeah.
What would be delta V over V that you'd be?
Oh, very small. I haven't done that calculation, but I have to think about it for a minute.
It
has to be less than a kilometer a second. It'd be very small. But it's systematic. It has to be systematic. Yeah. But very small.
So it's 1 kilometer a second.
So on the order of about a kilometer a second.
And compared to the velocities, which are?
Compared to which velocity you might? The width of the lines? The
absolute velocity of the lines.
What do you mean the velocity of the lines? You don't mean the redshift.
The
internal motions, that's what I'm saying. The internal motions are typically on the order of 100 kilometers a second.
So you have a crucial assumption. There's no systematic velocity effect at the order of 1%.
Right? That's right. What I'm saying is no matter where you look in the universe, okay, we're making the assumption that clouds here and there, that these nickel and iron lines don't approach each other at the level of 1%. That's correct. That's the assumption we're making. Yeah.
Is there any way of, a priori, if I had to compare varying fine structure constant, the level you're talking about, which, as you'll discuss later, has other problems, other measurements.
Right.
There's a 1% systematic error in velocity distribution.
Well, you'd have to explain to me physically why that happens.
Yeah. Is there any other way of bolstering that assumption from other data?
I'd have to think about that. No, it's just a physical argument that there's. I just can't think of a physical reason why clouds everywhere in the universe, as I keep saying, why is it that the nickel and iron, no matter where I look in the universe, always moving relative to each other like this, and the silicon and chromium move relative to that. I would expect that to be random, those velocities to random. To simulate this effect, they have to move in the same way no matter where you look. And that's what I find difficult, although I agree with you, it's a small effect. But you still, it has to be the same everywhere. And I think most astrophysicists find that difficult to accept, even though I agree with you, it's a small effect. Yes?
Well,
So when you talk about delta alpha, that's the difference between alpha z and alpha at the redshift.
Correct.
The point. So as you go to sort of larger redshift, if there was a systematic change in alpha, wouldn't you expect that delta alpha over alpha to be increasing?
Well, it depends what the systematic error is due to.
Yeah.
Well, I'll show you what, you know, it turns out some systematic errors are larger at low redshift than at high redshift. Depends what type of systematic. I'm going to discuss that. I'm going to spend a lot of time discussing that. Okay. All right, so now I want to get into that. What are the systematic errors? So, of course, you know, we calculated this. We calculated what the one sigma error is. So the question is, these are one sigma errors are the diagonal terms of the covariance matrix. Should we believe them? Okay. So at least I think in that case, the answer is yes. From this point of view, what we did is Monte Carlo simulation. So we start out with a system with zero change in fine structure constant. Go through the same, just simulate exactly the same data set that we observed, and calculate what the change in fine structure constant is. And because of errors, we're going to wind up with the changes in the fine structure constant. But we'll get a scatter in d alpha over alpha like this, okay, so with a mean of zero. And the nice thing is that the scatter that we come out with are consistent with the one sigma errors that we calculate. So at least you have confidence that the technique is self-consistent from that point of view. But there are other more serious system.
Right, so that, does that mean you really need to try and show? So this is really a test of the fact that if you give it data for which you know there's no fine structure constant change, you recover that.
Right.
So that's the test of the whole.
That's a test of the technique that we've been using. Exactly. But that's not the word. There are other more serious problems. All right. Now, one of the other problems we have, and I'm going to spend a fair amount of time talking about this, potential problem, so I don't think it is a problem, though, but it was a potential problem, is wavelength miscalibration. Remember, when we take the data at the telescope, okay, what we get, remember, is the device, which I'll show in a minute, is a CCD, okay, and we're going to get electrons in each different pixels, okay, and those, what we get is a spectrum, which is the number of photons or electrons as a function of pixel number. That's not wavelength number. So what we had to do is calibrate that CCD. And it's entirely possible the way we calibrate it, which is not straightforward, could have led to errors. So that's the next thing I want to talk about. So here I just want to drag you for some astronomy here. Really what happens is the light comes down in the Keck telescope to the primary mirror, gets reflected up to a secondary. And then from there, it gets sent to a third mirror, which is called a tertiary, which sits off to the side. And the light from there then goes into this high-res Schell spectrograph. High-res is like one of your offices. It's that big. It's a very big instrument. So the light comes in to this instrument. And the important thing is that it goes through a slit, a rectangular slit. So what is sent downstream is an image of this rectangular slit. So the light gets reflected off a collimator, which turns the focus light into parallel light. And the parallel light gets sent into an Schell. And the Schell is a diffraction gradient that works at high order. That's what gives you the high resolution. Then the light is diffracted off. Now, the price you pay with high orders, we basically work at an order of about 50, is that light that gets diffracted off into the same direction could have wavelengths that differ only by 30, 40 angstroms. So that leads to a lot of confusion. So as a result, so here the light, let's say, gets diffracted in the plane of the screen here. What we do is send it off to a cross disperser, which diffracts light out of the screen in a perpendicular direction, which separates the orders. So finally, what we're going to wind up with is basically a two-dimensional spectrum. That's what a Schell spectroscopy is. And then the light gets sent over here to a mirror and then gets into the CCD. Okay, so this is where the potential problems could arise. So here is sort of what we did is took at dusk, one of the evenings, what we observed, we took a spectrum of scattered sunlight. So this is what a Schell spectrum of scattered sunlight looks like. So each one of these is in a Schell order, and the wavelength increases in that direction along the order. And this is the order increasing like that. The wavelength increases over there. And there's some overlaps in wavelength, but we really know what is what. Now here you see this image of the rectangular slit at different wavelengths. Okay, the slit itself is about 5 arc seconds long, Okay. But that's not what the quasar, that's sunlight. Quasar shell spectrum doesn't look like that. It looks something like this. Remember, quasar is an unresolved object. That's why it's called a quasar. It looks like a star. And so these are the quasar. This is the quasar. Here you can see the slit. See, the quasar is smaller than a slit. The quasar is about 1 arcsecond in diameter. As I said, the slit's about 5 arcseconds. What you see here is a nice skyline. These are aerosols in the Earth's atmosphere that emit, and they're diffuse, and they illuminate the entire slit. All this junk over here, these white spots, are cosmic rays. We have to integrate for about 2 hours, okay, to beat out the readout noise. So this is the price we pay to get a lot of cosmic rays. But we have an efficient way of getting rid of them. But the important point, down here, this is Lyman alpha emission. And this is the Lyman alpha forest down here. You can just see it's much weaker, lots of absorption. The kind of guys that I'm interested in are over here, over here. This is an infamous ink spot that was one time interpreted as a deuterium absorption line. It was someone's thumbprint on the CCD. A paper was published. I won't say who. Okay. All right, now to calibrate things, what we do is we close the hatch. Sorry, things have... a lot of wind here or something. Oh, it's a fan, yeah, okay. So we close the hatch, and then we turn on a calibration lamp, thorium argon lines, whose wavelengths we know very precisely. So we go through the same thing. And what we see is something that looks like this. Okay, so these are these thorium argon calibration lines. So they tell us, okay, what the wavelength of each pixel is. But this is a laborious procedure. There's lots of these lines. Sometimes it's possible we could have misidentified them. And just a slight shift in this. Remember, we're looking for very small effects, as was said here before. And we want to make sure that we do that correctly. All right. And then we just calibrate. We just map pixel into wavelength. And that's what, this is one of the fits, just to show you that the fit, it looks excellent. But it's possible, just a small error in that could really screw us up. So what we do is a simulation, sort of an interesting experiment. So here is an object that has an iron two-line complex over here and a magnesium two-line complex over here. So what we do is we simulate these with thorium-argon lines, different thorium-argon lines that we use for the calibration, but we just treat them as if they were quasar absorption lines, okay? At this frequency and at that frequency. And we go through the same process. We just send them through the data analysis chain, except these are emission lines rather than absorption lines, but that doesn't really matter. And of course, we should find a null result because these are lines that are fired off in the Earth, and we know what the fine structure constant is today. So their relative wave numbers are okay. And when we do that, if we had miscalibrated things, okay, then we should have found an error. In that we should have found this spurious answer, but we don't, at least to the level that's important. Here's the quasar data. This is the alpha of alpha versus redshift. So we did this for each quasar. We simulated each of the absorption lines in the same way, and you can see that there's nothing okay in the way we identify lines. It could also be a distortion in the instrumental profile, which could have misled us. There's nothing that could reproduce these type of effects. When you amplify this by a factor of 10, there are systematic effects that are inconsistent with the error bars, but they're about a factor of 10 lower than the effect we see. So we no longer believe, we actually, this was, I think, a good test, that wavelength calibration errors could have misled us. The next type of error, probably the most serious error, was atmospheric dispersion. Remember, the Earth's atmosphere acts like a prism, disperses light in the direction of the zenith, perpendicular to the plane of the atmosphere. And so really what you want to do is have the slit lined up in that direction, okay, so that one wavelength doesn't get ahead of another before we go through the spectrograph. In the early days of Keck, for various technical reasons, there wasn't an image rotator. And so in the early days of Keck, some of the data that we had, the slit was not lined up to the zenith angle, it was like this. So if I had a wavelength lambda 1 over here and a wavelength lambda 2 over here, even before that was passed through the spectrograph, there was a dispersion of that light and that leads to a wavelength expansion, okay? And that could also cause trouble. Remember, a wavelength expansion at low redshifts means a positive change in fine structure constant if it's real. So what we did is calculated what is the maximum errors, and we corrected for that. And that means that if this really were a true error, that the fine structure constant had to be more negative than what we really calculated. So the red is the original data, and the green is the corrected data for this effect, if this effect operates. I'll show you in a minute that we no longer think it's really this strong at all. So the biggest corrections occur at low redshift, because all the shifts are the same. At high redshifts, this is the beauty of having everything shift in opposite directions. There's almost no correction whatsoever. Now, again, we used to worry about this a lot, but I'm no longer worried about it, because what we've done now with our new data, we've divided up the data sample into spectra without an image rotator and spectra with an image rotator, where we rotated the slit perpendicular in the direction of the zenith, and it had an almost equal number of absorbers. And you can see that the net effect and the change of fine structure constant is indistinguishable. So we really don't think that. And we think the reason that that correction was exaggerated is that correction makes sense if the quasar stays exactly at the same place on the slit. In reality, it never does. Okay, during the night, the object drifts relative to the slit. There are guiding errors, and so everything gets smeared out. Okay, and there's no clear separation of blue and red images like we had before. But in any case, empirically, that turns out to be not a major problem. The other problem that we have to worry about is isotope shifts. Remember that each one of these elements has isotopes. And the wavelength that we calculate is a composite of those isotope wavelengths weighted by the terrestrial abundance. That's how we do it, okay? Now, why are there isotope shifts? Again, let me just, this straightforward stuff, but remember that the frequency is proportional to the Rydberg constant. The Rydberg constant in the center of mass frame is proportional to the reduced mass of the electron, okay? And that means that the Rydberg constant for a finite mass nucleus is equal to this number divided by 1 plus me over the mass of the nucleus. So that means that the frequencies go like 1 minus me over the mass of the nucleus. So as I increase the atomic number, the frequencies shift upward. I get higher frequencies. So for example, if I go from magnesium 24 to magnesium 25, there's a shift downward in wavelength and a shift in velocity of about a tenth of a kilometer a second. So that's something to worry about. And here is an example of some of the shifts that we were. Now, I should say before I go on that this is only going to be important for light atoms because it goes like 1 over a squared. So it's in a way that's very fortunate because it means in this case, the errors are most important for the light nuclei, whereas the fine structure constant is being driven by the heavy nuclei. So this just shows what. Here's magnesium for three of its isotopes. These are the wave numbers. As I said, as you go up in mass, okay, the wavelengths get shorter, okay. Here we even worried about the hyperfine transitions, okay, and we populated them thermally, okay. But the point of the trouble with all this is we don't know at high redshift that the terrestrial isotope ratios are correct. I mean, it could be wrong. And in fact, there's evidence that if you go to lower metallicity stars, the evidence is as you go down and down in metallicity, these ratios get lower in abundance. This is about something like 5% rather than 10%, okay? And the damp Lyman alpha systems that I'm working with have a metallicity of about 1/30th times the solar abundance. They're very metal poor objects. So we took the extreme example. We got rid of all the isotopes except the primary one. Let's just take that extreme example. And as a result, the wavelengths shift upward compared to the composite wavelength. And at least for low redshifts, remember that's an expansion of the fine structure constant. That means, in fact, the real fine structure constant would be more negative than we measure. And so here is that correction, correcting for this extreme case where we don't have any of the weaker isotopes. And again, the corrections are largest at low redshifts for the reasons that I said before, and they're almost negligible at high redshifts. I'm sorry?
If you change it in the other direction for large Z,
Which direction? You mean if I meet everything at 25? Okay, then it would go in the other direction, right? But I think the magnitude of the effect, at high redshift, it wouldn't matter. It's only, the corrections are only significant at low redshifts. Because at high redshifts, things shift in the opposite directions. Okay, so, finally.
All your elements below iron, other than there's nickel, what's your heaviest?
The heaviest is zinc, I believe. That's, what is zinc? It's Z of 30, I think.
So for the lower elements, you'd expect them to be alpha either nuclear, magnesium 24,
right, so they're alpha enhanced, you'd expect them to be even more abundant. But what about the weaker isotopes? Do you remember?
No, I don't. I was just asking, I think for heavier elements, it's more complicated.
Right. Okay. There is evidence in damn Lyman alpha systems that we do have alpha enhancements. Is that what you're asking me? Am I?
Well,
I don't mean alpha fine structure. I mean the other alpha.
Right, different alpha. Yeah. So I was just saying for the lighter elements, you know, you expect mostly magnesium 24.
Right.
Okay. 25, it would be. I think it's a safe bet to imagine there's less 25.
Okay, but for the heavier elements, you're saying that?
The heavier elements, I have to think about.
Okay.
It's trickier for the heavier.
Okay. But remember, that effect is only important for the light elements because it goes like 1 over a squared. So at high redshift, it's only silicon that matters. So I think we're okay. All right. So finally, there's a general test. Okay. I mean, another possibility that there's an interloper. That every, you know, ion transition has some other thing we never even thought about that's distorting everything. So what we did is for each one of these transitions, we looked at the number of redshift systems that contain these, calculated the alpha over alpha, okay, before, and then we removed that transition and calculated afterward to see, you know, if there was some interloper when we removed that transition, then the effect would go away. And you can see right away that doesn't happen for every transition, okay. And I think what's nice about this, it also shows that there's no single transition that dominates the effect. The only problem is with the zinc and chromium blend, but there's only four okay, objects that have that, so we're not that really worried about that. Okay, so let me end, I'm almost finished, showing you the new data. So Wall Sargent has, also given us his data. So what, before we had 49 data points, we now have 138, okay? And this is the new result. Again, when you really work it out, most of the changes in the alpha over alpha are negative, okay?
The new data is the blue.
The new data is the blue. So it looks crappy over here, but it's not, okay? Because you're seeing the worst cases. There are a lot of, buried in here are a lot of cases with small error bars, okay? And again, you just work it out formally, and this is what you get when you bin the data. Okay, the change in fine structure constant is still negative, it goes to higher redshifts, and now the formal effect is significant at the six sigma level. Okay.
It looks like the error bars for the low redshift has also improved, right? It's also getting smaller. In the white,
Well, it varies. I mean, the new data is all blue, so some of the new data has small error bars, some of the new data has large error bars. Yeah. But the bottom line is the predominant. They're predominantly negative, okay? And again, it's the same telescope, the same instrument, the different observer, maybe.
Negative means it used to be weaker?
Yes, fine structure constant was weaker in the past than it is today, smaller, okay. So, how much more time do I have?
You have a few more minutes.
Okay, I'll just talk about some other constraints. I'm sure everybody here knows about this. There's a terrestrial constraint. It's a beautiful paper written by Freeman Dyson, number of years ago. I don't think it was his idea originally. I think it was a Russian physicist, Shliakter, but Dyson wrote this very nice paper showing that there, in West Africa, there's a natural fission reactor, the Oklo nuclear reactor, that operated about 2 gigayears ago. And what they were able to do by their analysis is to measure the neutron capture cross-section, okay, of some rare earths, in particular samarium 149. Okay, there was a fission reactor, there were high neutron fluxes. This is just for the astronomers in the audience, this is just S process, okay? These are S process elements. And they were able to show that the capture cross section, they were able to put bounds on that capture cross section. This is not really a cross section, this is a reaction rate, cross section times velocity averaged over a thermal distribution, normalized in a various way. And the nice thing, this is a resonant reaction, okay? So it depends sensibly on the energy of the state in which the reaction goes into. And they were able to show that the shift in that state compared to what it is today could not be more than this. It was the bound was about a tenth of an EV. And since that state depends on the Hamiltonian of the nucleus, they were able to put limits on the variations of the Coulomb contribution of that Hamiltonian. And they were able to put really very precise upper limits on the change of the fine structure constant. And notice it's a factor of two orders of magnitude below what we're seeing. So I think this is probably the most important constraint. Now, we don't overlap with this redshift. 2 billion years ago, we don't look at it yet. But clearly, we've got to do experiments that does overlap with this redshift range, and the results better be consistent. So that's, I think, a future test for us.
So you're seeing an effect that turned on.
We turned on not long before that, yeah.
How do you, something's bugging me.
Okay.
You're assuming the other fundamental constants don't change.
Like which ones?
Like ME over MP.
I don't think that, the Rydberg constant cancels out of all this.
No, you just had an Isenberg effect. If ME over MP was an actual Z.
Oh, okay, you mean in, okay, I'm sorry, I was thinking of the ratio. You mean the, right.
Cancels if it's constant.
Right.
There are other dimensionless parameters.
Okay, you're right, I'm sorry. I was thinking of the ratio effect, the Rydberg constant cancels out, but you're right, the isotope shift depends on one ME over M. That's right. But there are limits, there are limits on that from what I was showing earlier in my talk, that the alpha squared GP ME over MP is constant to 1 part in 10 to the 4.
I'm just wondering, in what sense are you measuring something for all the other systems that act on the time variation of alpha as opposed to perhaps other dimensions, parameters, like?
I mean, the changes of these atomic energy states, I don't think depend on ME over MP. I agree with you, the isotope effect does, the frequency shift does depend.
Like ME, period.
In its original effect, I think all those stuff cancel out. But it doesn't cancel out in the systematic errors, like for example.
Oh, that's right. No, in the systematic errors, it comes in.
Right, it's analyzing the systematic errors.
Yeah. Now, I think all we can measure in spectroscopy is dimensionless constants. I don't think we measure dimensional constants. We can get a handle on that. But I agree with you that ME over MP will affect the isotope shift. You're right about that. I agree with that. But not in this, the other effects. Okay, the other thing to worry about is there a time sense to this? Okay, I think the error bars are so big now, we really don't know. This is just a possible, this was a, from the original effect, this was a least squares fit to the data, which suggested that the fine structure constant was getting more negative as you go back in time. So the question is, you know, you can go all the way back to Big Bang, the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and ask, is our data consistent with changes of the fine structure constant extrapolated to the time of Big Bang nucleosynthesis? Because some people had said, no, your results are inconsistent with Big Bang nucleosynthesis, but I don't think that's true. Remember, what's the most important ratio is the helium abundance. And to zeroth order approximation, the helium abundance by mass is equal to 4 × 1/2 the neutron ratio. To a good approximation, all the neutrons at the time of when the universe was a temperature of about 0.5 MeV, all the neutrons wind up in helium nuclei. So the helium abundance is 4 × 1/2 the neutron abundance, neutron density times the neutron plus proton density at the time of freeze-out. Freeze-out is when the weak interaction rate equals the expansion rate, okay? Because later than that, things just, the expansion rate is much faster than the weak interaction rate. Okay, neutrons and protons are coupled by the weak interaction in the Big Bang. And so if I can measure, the helium abundance depends on neutron to proton ratio. At these temperatures, nuclei are non-relativistic, so the neutron to proton ratio goes like e to the minus the neutron minus proton mass divided by k times the temperature at freeze out. This is a phenomenological model that some high energy physicists came up with, and people here can tell me how well they agree with it. But it's basically MN minus MP. I think this is the mass difference between the down quark and the up quark. And this is the Coulomb, okay, contribution. And clearly, as alpha gets larger, the mass of the neutron minus the proton gets smaller, and the helium abundance will go up.
Now, how far are your highest redshift compared to the redshift?
Nothing at all. I mean, our highest redshift is 4. This is a redshift of what, 10 to the 10?
Something like. 10 to the
10. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you're really extrapolating.
Oh, yeah. But not in time. Remember, look, I'm not extrapolating that much in time. Uh-huh. Extrapolating a lot in redshift, right, but not in time.
Right. 2 billion years ago, it was 0.
No, I mean, I'm going from, say, 85% of the way back to 99% of the way back. Okay, so it's not a big extrapolation in time. So anyway, this is the, what happens is the helium abundance we know is a function of baryon to photon ratio, okay, which we know nowadays very well from the angular power spectrum of the CMB and also from deuterium abundances. And as I said, as the fine structure constant goes up, say by a factor of 5%, the helium abundance goes up like that. As the fine structure constant goes down, the helium abundance goes down. But we really know what this parameter eta is very well now. Okay, there it is. So this is what we think are the bounds on eta, because we know the micro background extremely precisely, how many photons per cubic centimeter is. We know what the baryon density is. However, there are fairly large error bars in the helium abundance. There are a lot of systematics in calculating the helium abundance. So the bottom line is that the bounds on the fine structure constant from this technique are no better than 1%. Okay, so it really is no important constraint at all. So I think the most important constraint is this Oklo nuclear reactor. And we have to understand, you know, why it's 2 orders of magnitude lower than we're finding. Okay, so I'll just end up by saying that what we're going to do in the future, not so much us, I think that this experiment has to be done independently at a different telescope. The only other telescope right now is the Very Large Telescope in Chile at the European Zone, and they have a very hot Schell spectrograph on that, and pretty soon there will be others. And so we're trying to encourage other people to go out and do this. It's a big investment of time. It's not the kind of thing astronomers like to do, but I think it's pretty important. It should be done. And then also ourselves, we're going to go to low redshift. We want to overlap with the Oklo experiment. That's not straightforward. We can go down to about a redshift of 0.2 from the ground. To go lower than that, we have to go into space. We have to use a space telescope and look at interstellar clouds in our galaxy, go through the whole thing, and we better find a null result. Okay, thank you.
Is there any evidence for directional dependence if you've been quasars?
No, I should have plotted that. No, there's not. I have a plot like that, but it's just red. There's no direction. There's no evidence for directional dependence.
Sorry.
Oh, he had another question.
Well, okay.
Will the low redshift observation kind of rule out telescope errors if you look at low redshift and don't see the effect?
I think what that would say is that our technique is very good. Okay, it would say that I mean, one worry we've always had is that maybe there's something about our analysis technique that's giving us spurious result. Although remember that one experiment I showed you where we ran the thorium-argon lines, I think, indicate that's not true. I think a low redshift null result would just say that there's nothing wrong with our technique and it's self-consistent.
With regard to the nucleosynthesis, I mean, if alpha varied, you might think the weak interaction coupling constant might vary in some way with it. And say the neutron half-life.
Okay.
Would that complicate the comparison with
I guess it would. I hadn't thought about that, Jim. So you're saying let that vary in such a way that it cancels the other effect? Is that what you mean?
No, I don't know. I mean, I'm just guessing.
Yeah.
I think the reason that the density, they have an exponential effect.
Pardon?
Boltzmann factor.
Right.
Whereas what you're talking about is just proportional, so effective.
So you think this is more sensitive?
Oh, well,
yeah.
Because it's exponential.
Okay.
Okay, question from Lars.
Jeff Marcy and Vogt are using the same instrument with planet velocities at tens of meters a second.
There you go. Yeah.
Which is more accurate than you'd love to have that accuracy. So can you tell us a little bit about your calibration
Yeah, that's a very good question. Remember, they're looking at 6-magnitude stars.
I'm not saying.
And we're looking at 18th magnitude. Yeah, I mean, what they do is they put an iodine cell in the light path. And we'd love to do that because then they're calibrating the data simultaneously with getting the quasar. We're going to try that. The problem is that the brightest quasar we have right now is about 17th magnitude. And when we put that iodine cell in there, it's just going to really screw up the spectrum pretty badly. It's going to give us a lot of noise, and it may be very difficult to do it. But that is the ideal way to do the wavelength calibration.
So I guess what I'm asking, though, is that they for a given run, know what the pixel wavelength mapping is.
Right.
Is it different?
But you can't use, you know, what one run for another run.
No, I understand that.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm asking is, I mean, it just seems to me that you'd want to at least try to compare what you found with a given same exact set of, you know.
Yeah.
It's
no,
a,
as a,
that comparison, I mean, they're doing stuff that's 10 times more accurate.
That's right.
And
yeah.
So just
the trouble is that calibration changes from night to day, you know. So it's got to be done exactly at the same time. That's why that comparison is not easy to do.
Right. So I guess in some sense, then, that casts skepticism for me on what you're doing. Because if it changes from then night to night and I have to measure it, then how can you ever calibrate it if you're not doing it simultaneously with each separate phase?
Well, we do it the same night. We take a spectrum, and about a half hour later, we calibrate it.
Okay, so for each of these...
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's crucial.
Yeah, okay.
We calibrate it the same night, almost the same time. In fact, we do as many calibrations as possible. But I agree with you. Ideally, the way to do it is the way they do it. It's to do it simultaneously, because then you're looking at the same light paths. But as I said, the price we pay is that it makes the light, you know, it's just a thicket of iodine absorption lines that they put, and it'll basically lower the magnitude of the quasar, make it noisier. It'll add a considerable amount of noise to the spectrum. But we're going to try it anyway, definitely.
Other questions? Gary?
So could you remind me, what is the lowest redshift that you currently have data for?
I have to look at it. I don't remember. It's about 0.5, 0.4, something like that.
Just a factor of 2 away from its outflow bound. I mean, it does indicate some sort of...
Well, let's look at the... It's about a factor of 2 in time. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have that. We can do that. No, I agree. It means that this effect...
We're living in a special time.
So it's another coincidence problem. Another cosmic coincidence. Just when the cosmological constant turns on.
So, all right. No, it's a little better than what you said. It's a redshift of 1. This is about a redshift... No, it's better than what you said. A redshift of 0.5. The universe is about 6 billion, 7 billion years old. And a redshift of 0.1, it's about 12 billion years old. So it's more than a factor of 4. So it's a lot of
question here.
So for your future low redshift environments, what kind of accuracy do you have?
Well, we're waiting. The Space Telescope is getting a new spectrograph called COS, which is much better than the wavelength right now, which is very accurate. And so what we're going to do is use background stars, maybe not crazy, and look at interstellar clouds throughout the galaxy. And then we can see the same transitions that we're looking at high redshift and do exactly the same technique. And we better find out the results.
So the
accuracy
will be comparable?
I think so. I don't have the specs, but I think what I've heard, right now it's not comparable. The wavelength, the reason we didn't even bother we're trying to use the Space Telescope right now, so it's not, the calibration is not that accurate. But what I'm told is that the future spectrograph will be the same accuracy that the higher is.
Other questions?
Yeah, I mean, since you've gotten a lot of publicity in the last few months, have you heard of any other, has anyone else come up with ideas that independently?
You mean any ideas that?
What are new ideas? No one particularly terrestrial.
You mean to explain the results theoretically,
other
or
other experiments?
Oh, other experiments.
No.
As I said, this is it took 5 years to get all this data.
No, I don't mean this way of doing it.
I mean a different technique to go that far back in time. Yeah. You mean like a terrestrial experiment? Is that what you mean? Well, I mean, you can find an open. Apparently, there are no nuclear reactors
beyond 2 billion years. And a geologist explained it to me, because that's because there was outgassing of oxygen 2 billion years ago in the Earth's atmosphere. And you need iron oxides. They're the only ones that become soluble in water. And those neutrons have to come out of water and be moderated, and that's how you get the fission process going. It's all news to me. And so it's unlikely that you can have it would be beautiful to have these nuclear reactors, say, operating, you know, 4.5 billion years ago in the Earth first form, but apparently there wasn't enough oxygen.
Between E, H, and C, are there some other constraints where you can foresee and say for me might be guaranteed?
Not by spectroscopy. You mean empirically? No. No. Well, it
doesn't mean anything.
You mean z squared in actual units? Is that what you mean?
Compared to the Washington
Street. Dr. Srinath, if you're talking about the micro-electron radiation from the matter, it would be sensitive to this.
That's correct. That's right. It changes the decoupling epoch.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't look at that. Someone just told me that. It does affect exactly the locations of the peaks. That's right, because what you're measuring, the location of the peaks depends on the angle diameter of the fluctuations of the last 750. And that does put up a limit on it. But I know it's compatible with everything. But I don't remember the exact numbers, I'm sorry.
There's another very strange phenomenon. All the questions came from this side. No questions at all from this side.
It's very good question.
Yeah, when is that the six? Okay, further questions?